and Islamic modernism, secular religion, civil society, and contemporary politics in Bangladesh. It's a privilege, joy, and an honor to have a colleague and a scholar of the caliber of Professor Nasim Hussain with us. I warmly welcome the two things she's trying to put together, religion and modernity. And since we have concocted this title in my study, I'll speak for one more minute as to why this topic is so important, not only for the reality of Bangladesh, but also for an ongoing conversation in this institute and at this university. I'm talking about the problem of modernity and conceptual flow. We, several of my colleagues, have joined together in the excellence cluster to ask, how do we understand what we know, and how can understanding also sometimes become a method of undermining, and what do those who are undermined through the process of understanding do about it? If you think of it that way, you'd understand why many aspects of politics in South Asia are not easily intelligible in terms of imported concepts. Take the case of the part of the world now known as Bangladesh, previously East Bengal, and if you go even further in terms of a confluence of many different cultures. Now this is the part of the British Empire where a movement against the British started for the first time, when Bengalis were taking resort to terrorism to fight colonial rule. They thought they were emboldened by the waves of modernity. The books they were reading were also the books that brought modernity to Europe. Think of that high point and think of the dissolution of that modernity in communal violence at the time of partition, and further degeneration of those items in the politics that followed. If you look at it simply in terms of a linear view of modernity, you probably think politics has somehow degenerated, that these new forms of politics are essentially reactionary. That would be one way of looking at it. And that is how I started when I was doing a compendium of modern politics in South Asia. So I asked myself, these other forms of politics, terrorists, so-called fundamentalists, or radical in the Marxist way, might appear non-modern to the European students of modernity, but to those people, they are not necessarily non-modern. There is probably another way of pulling together these many forms of politics which are not recognizably modern, but probably are pulled together by another form of modernity, which I started calling relative modernity. Now, relative modernity is appealing at the first sight, but if you ask further, you'd ask, relative to what? To whom? Why is it? I was recently in a conference in Bolzano on new cultures, and I was having a debate with colleagues from clergy who were talking about girls at universities, and this is something I've also talked to Nasim about. These girls are covering their face in order to assert themselves against their mothers, their aunts, who have fought for the right not to have to cover their faces. So who is right, who is wrong? Relative modernity is fine, but if you don't go one step further, and that is where our conversation ended, and I'm waiting to hear the rest from Nasim. Otherwise, you end up in the world of Alice in Wonderland, where everyone gets a prize. Everyone becomes modern in her own way. Now, as students of political science, we can't give in to that kind of radical solipsism or radical relativism. So we don't like modernity which undermines us, but we don't want to give up the academic or intellectual or scientific life to have a conversation where we share categories. I hope you see the epistemological problem that we find ourselves in the midst of. How do we understand without undermining, but how do we not give in to the bullying of the undermined in the name of categories which he doesn't care to deconstruct any further? Islam is enough, Hinduism is enough, Buddhism is enough. I, of course, want both ways. I want to be modern and legitimate and let the conversation continue in terms of further deconstruction. So I'm looking for a halfway house between imported modernity and indigenous categories which refuse to be further deconstructed. That brings me to Nassim, who would bring us further, but in not more than, let us say, 15 minutes, because I'll send you a signal. We have to have a conversation about your lecture, and some people must leave at 6:30.
Thank you.
The floor is yours.
The title of my paper is An Islamic Modernity, Religion and Human Society in the Context of Contemporary Bangladesh Politics. This is written on the basis of my current research on religion and modernity in Bangladesh, but I have developed it theoretically after coming here, talking to Professor Mitra and few other academics, and using the valuable SAI library. So, is there an Islamic modernity? I have been increasingly curious about the growing involvement of urban women with fundamentalist form of Islam since encountering newly veiled modern female students in the university where I teach in Bangladesh, and which is reputed to be a progressive campus for being able to resist penetration of Islamic political forces. And in all the movements in the campus, female students lead the movements. So in my encounter with these newly veiled female students, I was even more curious to conduct a study when they responded to my expression that I was not able to communicate properly with these veiled students when I could see only their eyes while all their body was covered. They said, "It is not a problem for us. We can communicate." To the question how they can pursue higher studies when they are veiled, they said, "We have only covered our heads, not our brains." Rather, they asked me a difficult question. Does it mean that religious women in Bangladesh cannot be modern at the same time? I tried to know about the choices these women are making to understand the impact of Islamist movement on their lives. Subsequently, I also studied few other religious groups with whom I got access to my students in Dhaka who participate in the ongoing Islamist movement in Bangladesh. Thus, I raised the question, is there an Islamic modernity? In finding an answer, I want to discuss how religion and gender issues have been entangled with contemporary Bangladesh politics and society, especially the complexity of their transformation as a result of neoliberal economic and politics in response to globalization. I understand Lira Abulugu's position, who in the context of Afghanistan questioned American intervention and Laura Bush's speech in terms of saving Afghan women from the tyranny of race. She argued for cultural differences of women, but the present context of Bangladesh is different. It is true that Porta has a long history in Bangladesh. The practice of sexual segregation, female modesty, and propriety has always been valued, and so it can be said that the ideology behind veiling has been present. But this was not problematic. these have no scriptural or dogmatic sanction. And Bourdieu termed beliefs of this kind as doxa, which appear as self-evident representations of the natural order, and that is why they provide legitimation and endure. Hijab, or new religion in Bangladesh, has attracted much attention because it is different from cultural practice of Purdah. The phenomenon is more complex and has political, economic, and socio-cultural dimensions as well as religious ones. This is not merely a return to traditional values and forms of dress, although the new regime has introduced new types of dress. While previously covering head with Bengali dress sari was enough, now women wear dress as veils, which are imported from the Middle Eastern countries. Women wear those over normal dress and cover their heads with scarf, cover mouth and the edge of the nose with a piece of cloth called niqab, and sometimes even wear black spectacles. Ideally, this outfit is called hijab. The outfit can be made more fashionable by making changes in design and color. The new veiling dress has questioned the effectivity of Bengali sari for maintaining women's modesty. However, sari symbolizes Bengali nationalism, while hijab imported from the Middle Eastern countries symbolizes Muslim nationalism. There is also a growing tendency among women for wearing Pakistani dress, shalwar kameez, which is more comfortable as a working dress and falls in between Bengali sari and Muslim hijab. Now, Bangladeshi women wearing hijab in city streets have become increasingly common. All this is related to the spread of Islamist movements, modernist forms of Islam, which have grown up gradually as part of the Muslim response to modernity. The use of hijab or other forms of veiling is a key symbol of such a return. Fatima Marmiti's question is useful to raise in Bangladeshi context. She says, if fundamentalists are calling for the return to the veil, it must be because women have been taking off the veil. Now, in Bangladesh, changing demand for women's labor as a result of capitalist development and newly developed consciousness about the rights of women as a result of NGO activities, media exposure and women's movements have caused more public visibility of women. Moreover, Bangladesh government's development policy from import substitution to export-led development has also opened employment opportunities for women, especially in the garment factories. The Islamist forces react to these developments. Now, in their views, Western development programs for women come packaged with Western feminist ideals, which are perceived as immoral and damaging to the fabric of Islamic society. It is advocated that these development ideals interfere with women's familial roles, giving rise to numerous domestic conflicts. A common question is, can wearing new veils by the urban educated women be interpreted as lack of awareness? Many researchers argue that by not recognizing women's other regarding choices as rational, women's agency may be underestimated. Many of the women I talked admitted that they adopt an overtly Muslim identity and the veil for strategic reasons, often to persuade their families to allow them to attend university or as a way of avoiding the harassment of the men on the street or common e-season. Veiling also provides women from poor and non-elite backgrounds with a way to raise their status. For some other women, structured and disciplined Islamic ideal life and veil make them good Muslim women image and helps them to find suitable marriage partners. New wales are mostly owned by middle class urban women who safeguard their honor and status by maintaining distance from the lower caste women, who are more visible in the public and have some form of economic empowerment. At the same time, they do not want to be left out altogether of the new opportunities offered by development. When they are caught in between home and the outside, compromise with new wales allows them Islamic license to enter public space and take part in activities that development offers. Now, women are actually markers, their identity markers. To return to the question I gave, is there an Islamic modernity in Bangladesh? My observation is that Islamism itself is not yet dominant within Bangladesh society, but Islamist groups are leading social movements. Some women's responses are aligned with the new wailing movement. For majority of the newly wailed women, Islam has become a counterculture to Western, constructed as immoral, and Bangladeshi, viewed by them as violent. It is clear that they want a different kind of society for themselves. But now, this raises the further question, will it lead to Islamic feminism in Bangladesh? Women are considered to be the symbols of culture and tradition, and at the symbolic level, they constitute the identity markers. When there is a call by the Islamists for returning to the origin, this call is first addressed to women. The Islamists face an ambivalence toward female emancipation because they need to address two conflicting demands: the prosperity, which requires modernization, and identity, which is rooted in tradition. The new value of women serves the purposes of patriarchy and thus both religion and capitalism. Now, alternative modernity of the Islamists. Fundamentalism is a polemical term representing an essentialized anti-modernism. The term is used polemically to polarize debate or create enemy images like clash of civilizations or the antithesis to science and reason. However, matters are more complex in reality. My experience in Bangladesh is that the adherents of Islamic resurgence are against parts of modernity, but they use modernist weapons, work with modernist spirit, and aim at bringing reforms for modernist view of religion. Islamization discourse has grown through its opposition to Western cultural and political hegemony. At the same time, it has appropriated Western knowledge and technology and has developed through interaction with modernity. Islamization, as observed in Bangladesh, can be identified as a call for returning to original Islam, return to the observance of the texts of Quran and Hadith. One significant aspect, the quest for origin, is that it does not call to go back to Bengali origin. On the contrary, these localized religious practices are labeled pejoratively as custom or beda, so must be forbidden. Contemporary devotional practice of visiting mazars or shrines by women and following directions from peer or religious person are also condemned. While the Islamists criticize Western way of life for being polluted by consumerism, materialism, and self-indulgence, they advocate establishment of lifestyles characterized by morality and faith. This lifestyle is not necessarily devoid of modern facilities. Regarding impact of Islamic reform, Ernest Gell-Mann, 1981, commented that the severe discipline of Puritan Islam, far from being incompatible with modernization, might be compatible with or positively favorable to modern social organization. Now, place this problem in context and try to develop what neo-colonialism or like what people would call it market fundamentalism is doing to Bangladesh, but in the context of Bengali notion of power and politics. So I say this, the Bengali aspiration for poetics of power. Gibbs' concept of poetics of power is useful in understanding Bengali notion of power. An observation of the traditional Bengali culture depicts that Bengalis idealized power as something arising from human consent that is freely given in an expressed or tacit manner. This is similar to Max Weber's notion of power, who states that rulers have to justify their domination in terms of charisma, tradition, and law. Gibbs' theater state is not an institutionalization of power, but it is the capacity to make decisions by which others are bound with coercion as its expression, violence as its foundation, and domination as its aim. The king is the perfect center, and he tries to be as close to divinity as possible, to be an example of it, and he is also an exemplary for his subordinates, and as a result, theater state is a reign of cosmology. This is similar to Bengali ideology, that some people will command and others will obey, but a delicate web of social relationships could be established to create a human bond, and this harmony will prevail for everyone. The Bengali moral social order is characterized by humanness as the rule of deference applies to superiors. The adjustment of the Bengalis with the cruelties of nature has increased their adaptive capacity, humanness in their personality, and collective thought in their social organization. When persons are asked how they are surviving, a common answer is, objected by charity, we are living with the help of the society. Past is five, that is symbolic. The Bengali moral economic order is characterized by a give and take relationship, and redistribution of wealth and resources is symbolized by the rituals of, say, sharing of food, particularly by the rituals of harvest, which is called Navanno. The unfortunate are entitled to the patronage of the rich. The Bengali mode of thought also exemplifies a political system characterized by a combination of outwardly authoritarian and inwardly democratic principles, but not vice versa. It is said commonly, shashan kara tari sathe shobhab kore jebo. Only those can rule who rule with benevolence. This means that although people here emphasize order, the innate passion is for democracy, not autocracy. One vital question regarding this is, how can people establish their long-desired democracy, which they always kept culturally hidden? More importantly, how can democratic rule be established by people who do not live in democratic societies and are exposed to autocratic political environment? Now, instead of the politics of power, Bangladesh establishes hegemony of power. Now, instead of the aesthetics of traditional social relation for the sake of harmony, Bangladesh has established hegemony of power at the state level. It can be understood by Gramsci's concept of hegemony. The hegemony in Bangladesh has been established through capitalist penetration and recently through neo-economic liberalism and globalization. These factors have greatly affected the socio-economic relations among the people and have increased contradictions and antagonisms instead of harmony. Broadly speaking, the global restructuring of capitalist economy integrated Bangladesh into world markets. in Bangladesh, the dominance of market forces, information and communication technologies, political and social liberalism, and consumerism have failed to promote equitable development. Now, the new economic and political forces bring different concepts into confrontational relations in the present context of Bangladesh. First confrontation I see is equality versus inequality. It is observed that free market is not poor friendly. Second confrontation is growth versus equity, and poor people who do not have the purchasing power to intervene in the free market, and as a result, number of developments refuses increase. As a result of globalization, number of environmental refugees is increasing because of the contamination by industries of wealth and rivers, destruction of habitat, cultural systems, and ecosystems. Third confrontation is market versus state. The one dangerous aspect is that corporations are financially and politically more powerful than national states. It seems that government of Bangladesh has to protect foreign investment and investors even if they cannot do so for their own citizens. Fourth confrontation is greed versus compassion. The moral order seems to be polarized when caring, nurturing, cooperation are termed as private values, and selfishness, competition, and aggression are termed as public values. Fifth confrontation is men versus women. Now, poor, illiterate, and malnourished people in Bangladesh are women, and globalization makes them even poorer. And sixth confrontation is between might and right, because violence and militarization are accompanied by internal colonization. All these new features have challenged the understanding of the people of the nature of state, power, and politics. Needless to mention that the moral social order and the moral economic order are created only in a situation when social insurance mechanism remains operative. Another noticeable aspect is that in the Bengali mode of thought, state is abstract, distant, and imaginary, which is supposed to be divine, benevolent, and an ultimate authority on earth to appease them. Apprehension is that when the state appears to the people as oppressors, the traditional Bengali conception does not allow them either to admit this as real or to consider it as bad. Therefore, a massive reaction is turning out to be alienation of the dispossessed class from politics, primarily led by national bourgeois with support from rural elite class. Now, I would like to focus on the nature of the state, which is actually the neoliberal state, and I said that there is violent creation of order. Actually, democracy in Bangladesh is in transition, and because primarily the first thing is that democracy is based on weak foundation where nationhood is questioned. And some researchers in Bangladesh comment that Bangladesh is an unfinished revolution, and when others think that a low-intensity cultural war is going on in Bangladesh. Dichotomy agrees on the question of the ideology of nationalism in Bangladesh politics, and two major political parties, Awami League and BNP, along with their supporters, are at loggerheads. A recent resurgence of Islamic fundamentalism has raised the question, which one will survive in this ideological fight, Bengali culture or Islamic culture? The two parties believe quite separate versions of their participation in the War of Liberation too, and they trade on their stories. And well, the textbooks are also changed, whoever goes to power, all the textbooks have changed according to their participation, their mission of war liberation. Now, regarding democracy, you can say that cultural values actually do not stand in the way of liberal democracy, but the ruling elites and vested groups stand on the way of practicing it, as they are afraid of losing unmerited privileges of democracy. Hence, democracy remains as a tactic of the ruling class. democracy also remains very much procedural, because election is very much popular, but human rights is not. And also the Islamic groups would consider democracy as majoritarian democracy, and whoever wins, okay, democracy is done. And the human rights question, they would just ignore, and they won't put into perspective or go for debate on that. All right. So, I can say something on the manipulating religion for political purposes. Okay. So, Bangladesh is witnessing a constant invocation of religion in the area of politics, and as a result of that, the growth of political Islam is occurring. Now, in order to understand this new development, primordialist versus instrumentalist debate can be referred. Which, according to Francis Robinson, the primordialist position is that political identities are given, as opposed to this Paul Bragg, and views that political identities are chosen. Although neither of the models speak totally, the instrumentalist model has more relevance for Bengali Islam, being less orthodox and containing the spirit of Sufism, and being converted from Hinduism, Bengali Muslims are more humanist and produce liberal philosophical thoughts nourished in Bengali peasant cultural environment. It can be put this way, that whether someone is Muslim first and Bengali second, or Bengali first and Muslim second, is not problematic. Mobilization of people on the basis of either identity in the past also proved to be possible by people's participation in the creation of Pakistan and Bangladesh. However, domination of Islamic identity will be problematic, because it will question the purity of the Bengali religious identity as it occurred in Pakistan, and Bengalis protested against such attitudes of Pakistani ruling class. In post-independence era, the objective conditions changed. Now, the leaders needed to establish a new social order. Awami League tried to manipulate through four fundamental principles of the state: nationalism, secularism, socialism, and democracy. But it soon lost legitimacy for being unable to build exploitation-free just society. The ruling elite then started using Islamic rhetoric and emphasizing Islamic practices in the public sphere. Extracts from all major religions are broadcast in the radio and television, and budgetary allocation for madrasa was increased. Most of all, Mujib joined Islamic summit and conference. Just after independence, Islamic Academy, which propagates ideals of Islam, was banned, but then it was revived. War criminals of 1971 were not trialed. Moreover, general pardon was given to the collaborators. All these lenient policies towards religio-political forces could not save regime, rather they gradually intensified. And later, we found that relationship between Islam and the polity served the purpose of legitimizing and civilianizing Jia's rule, as state power was captured through military coups. Now, religious dimension is greatly evidenced in the behavior pattern of the elites too. And we see that politicians now use Islamic idioms, phrases, rituals, and regularly make pilgrimages to Mecca. And since 1991, Bangladesh is going through a democratization process, but by then, Islam has acquired a space in political discourse already. And Jamaat-e-Islam is gaining very well. Their seats in the parliament increased up to 18 in the last political regime. And number of Islamist parties are also increasing. As in the election of 2001, more than 15 Islamist parties contested. So there is a discursive shift toward Islamism, which can be called as religious fundamentalism. In post-colonial Bangladesh, over the years, actually, mass poverty has increased, inequality has widened, and middle class has declined. Too much wealth has been accumulated in the hands of too few rich. The free market economic policies of government have made the situation worse. Many industries, including jute mills, sugar mills, have been closed down as a result of IMF and World Bank policies. About 1.5 million female workers in garment industries are paid half of what male workers are paid for doing the same work. Besides exploitation, cheap female labor, they are forced to work longer hours in deplorable working conditions without social security and other basic rights. 12% of the total workforce are child laborers, who are about 5 million in number. Out of total 140 million people, 25% earn less than a dollar per day, and 30% earn $1 per day. Now, the limitations of the ideological ruling class to compromise with global forces in pursuit of its capitalist path of development is thus transferring the burden of the resultant crisis on the shoulders of the common people created contradictions. The manifestation of these contradictions and social divide contribute towards the process of class formation. The contradictions also lay the objective basis on which the present concerted offensive of the religio-political forces has been mounted. The ruling elite explored the massive discontent of the people, perpetuate their fragile consciousness, and divert discontent into communal channels in pursuit of political objectives. Now, what the Islamists are doing, they are trying to create an Islamic state within the state. And how do they do that? I just quickly mentioned that. So the policy of the Islamists to participate in electoral politics brought them to the center of power. Now, I have conducted a study in the campus on the student organization of Jamaat-e Islam. Actually, all the student organizations of all the parties are important, but the student political organization of the Jamaat-e Islam conducts their recruitment in a different way. Like, male and female students coming from rural areas usually have financial difficulties and feelings of insecurity, who are assisted by the student organizations with money, subsidized housing, healthcare facilities, and she mobilizes the rural communities surrounding the public universities towards Islamic politics and develops kinship-based relations with them. It is very difficult for Jahanginagar and other universities outside of Dhaka, because then all these universities surrounded by villages, and they just make camps in those villages. They develop matrimonial relationships there, kinship. And whenever there is any problem or fights between the students group, they have their shelter in the surrounding villages, but other groups don't have that. But they do it very intelligently. And at the start, actually, from when from the village students start coming, they just lead them to the coaching center, starting from the coaching center, telling them all the steps with them, and whatever is their insecurity, they will just stand beside them. So this relationship is more than political kind of relationship. Now another institution is Tabligh. Tabligh is well known, Tabligh Jamaat, as a preaching society. And they go out for 40 days till go out and move around in the villages and preach Islam. But what is new about it now is that previously women didn't go for 40 days moving around. But there is a new institution that women, just the relatives, female relatives of these pilgrims, they will go with them. And more interestingly, these women will work in the villages. So it is creating a problem like this, that rural women are they practice Bengali Islam, what we call Bengali Islam, with all those synthetic rituals and everything, cultural things. But now, this public, what they are doing, they are teaching Christian Islam to these women, to the rural women, which was missing, which it never happened before. So that's the knowledge of Islamic faith and Sharia is made accessible and widely spread among rural women by women speakers. This is a new phenomenon in Bengali Islam characterized by synthetic elements whose followers are mainly women. Now another thing is that public universities are there currently, but also private universities. During the last decade, mushroom growth of private universities has occurred, which are market-driven. Now, when Jamaat-e-Islami works in public universities, this group Tahrir works in the private universities. This group was founded in Jerusalem in 1953, with ambitions a Sharia-based Khilafah of state. The political ideology of this group is quite radical, but its approach for implementation is modern, because they would organize seminars, discussion sessions, study circles, and they would just publicly also say that they are following the strategies of previous Communist Party strategies, that students used to have study circles, they used to, they had to study and report, and books were assigned by the political parties. So similarly, they are also doing this. Now, the students of these private universities are attractive targets of the Islamists because they come from well-off families and they are the future decision makers of big business enterprises. Their modern ways of life and dress are not attacked in the beginning, although gradually they are motivated to follow Islamic way of life. In all these private universities, they come from rich background and they would wear jeans or shorts. But these Islamists won't question it in the beginning. They'll just allow it, but gradually they will try to motivate. And it is also seen that some of these universities, at least I found about 7 private universities which are owned by Jamaat activists. These are owned by, like Manara, Asian, Dar es Salaam University. And Islamic ethics, Islamic history and civilization, Muslim law, these are newly included subjects which they are teaching. Now, in the what they are doing in the villages, there is a change. I'm going to it very shortly, but in the villages, they are actually organizing social groups. Like in the last political regime, they had the portfolio of social welfare and industry. And these two ministers actually created space in the rural areas, and they went for social service, cultural activities, sports, rallies, seminars, and disaster management. These were previously actually done by local young groups, but these days they can't do. They would say that, oh, we don't have enough money. So they'll go to the NGOs for money for conducting a sport or something like that. And these Islamic groups are now organizing them very well, and this is creating actually an impression, a good impression in the rural areas. And maintaining close interaction with local culture is a new communicative strategy of the Islamists. And for the market, also we have found that the fundamentalists have progressed toward building a strong economic base of their own through establishing various profitable institutions like the financial institutions, banks, insurance, leasing companies, educational institutions, madrasas, English medium schools, colleges, private universities, sporting centers, pharmaceuticals, diagnostic centers, health-related institutions, trade, real estate, and transport, or the news media, or information technology, and local NGOs, and business organizations. And what is happening is that they collect money from the Middle Eastern countries, they invest the money for profitable ventures, and then they use a part of profit for these ventures. And it is interestingly that I observed that people belonging to the middle class and unstable lower middle class are sympathizers of Islamist activities, and they feel encouraged to get services from Islamist enterprises, forming a beneficiary kind of group. The common Bengali Muslims are, in general, inspired to donate for the cause of Islam. A popular approach by the mullahs is, if you donate one penny for mosque or madrasa, you will get God's blessings amounting up to 70 pennies. In modern perspective, this has changed, and now Islamists encourage Muslims to purchase goods and services from Islamic institutions and thus do something for the cause of Islam and earn God's blessings. Those who possess black money want to make them white by donation for the cause of Islam, and thereby making themselves spiritually clean. Now, media is another very effective institution which is actually exploding. Islamists are increasingly using media to a modern life to lead Islamic interpretations to a diverse audience of class and gender. When I was a child, I can still remember that even using microphone was not allowed by the mullahs. No, this is Western, this is modern, this is science. No, we don't go for it. So. But now they're using media, electronic media, print media, especially electronic media, and among about seven channels, electronic media, at least four of them are owned by the Jamaat-e-Islami people. Now, especially in the electronic media, I find that women appear in talk shows with hijab, and their text-based scholarship makes them equally popular like male ulamas. They feel themselves like previously ulama used to talk about text Islam. Now they can also do that. So not only textual, but social and behavioral analysis of Islamic life and contemporary applications are presented in the media for the masses. A blurring of boundaries is observed, and a middle ground is opening to fill up the gap between super literate authoritative discourse and folk Islam of the general mass. Now, like Daniel Lerner's The Passing of Traditional Society, it can be said that the changes brought by the media in Bangladesh are offering practical pluralism and are giving shape to multiple dimensions of modernity instead of Western capitalist model of modernity. Now, about the NGOs, actually Islamists are critical to NGO activities of microcredit for charging interest because it is forbidden in Islam. But now there are over 450 NGOs under their control. And it is, I can comment that while the donors of Middle Eastern countries support NGOs for a mission, the donors of the Western countries demand specific results. And well, these days this has changed radically because NGOs have turned into like corporate institutions, and it's very cost, it has to be cost effective, so they forget about people. But in the background, religious forces are going with the mission. Now, religious education is very important to mention because we find that madrasas, they serve important function by offering education, especially to children from poor backgrounds. These institutions offer a free education, room and board to their students, and thus they appeal to the impoverished families and individuals. Now, on the whole, these religious schools are supported by private donation from Muslim believers through a process of almsgiving and through a portion of zakat, and that is charity that is given for these madrasas. Now, one achievement of the Islamists is the rising number of madrasas. As you can see, that during the rule of Ershad, the military ruler, the number of government-affiliated madrasas went a hundredfold increase, a nearly 300% increase in the number of staff and enrollment of students. And however, government's policy towards madrasas is also positive, as it is found that after independence, the number of madrasas has increased 8 times, which while the secular primary schools doubled only 2 times. In the same period, enrollment in primary schools doubled, but those in madrasas increased 13 times. Now, civil society, I'm almost at the end. Now, the civil society, my observation is that it's far away from challenging this hegemonic mechanism. It is well recognized that civil society is a non-state actor and is a catalyst for social political transformation. Civil society is broadly accepted as part of social movements also. And it has a rich history in India and Bangladesh. During British colonial rule, Western-educated local elite in Bengal started social reform movements, which subsequently became associated with anti-colonial resistance. Ultimately, these movements led to the formation of political party platforms. The civil society and political party in parallel ways or through alliance and sometimes competitively led anti-British and later anti-Pakistan movements. For example, the language movement was first initiated by the student groups and intellectuals backed by the political leaders and gradually gained support from all sections of people. Okay. Now, what is happening now is that instead of alliance, it is now cooperation by the political parties which are actually not actually allowing the community to grow. And you can see in the chart, yeah, here, it's done in Russia in one district only, where among 501 student society groups, and there you find that the ruling party, which was the ruling party, BNP, 65% of their contact with BNP, with army, even with Jamaat, 33.5, almost 34% contact, and with also Communist Party, 9.8. This means that even all these NGOs and different groups, they are somehow related to political parties. As this is dangerous because as the political parties have conflicting identities regarding nationalism, Islam, or the monoculture sort of division. So when all these groups also have political affiliation, they also get divided. And we find very much that generally the intellectuals are considered to be the driving force in Bangladesh. Most of the movements in the past are led by them, even Bangladeshi movement started in Dhaka University, which the whole nation is proud of. But now all the university teachers, students, and even the lawyers, they also have political affiliations and they divide it in party lines. But a new dimension has come to this is that new concept, think tank and citizens group, these concepts have come, and the intellectuals are actually getting membership into think tank or citizens group, and media is very much attracted to them, and they go regularly to the media and in the talk shows. But these think tank and citizens groups, they are also divided in ideological and party lines, and most of their organizations are donor-supported. Most importantly, labor movement in Bangladesh has been on the decreasing trend because of political parties that insinuated the major trade unions. Okay. Now, about NGOs, there is a debate whether we consider NGOs a civil society or not, but in Bangladesh context, NGOs started working with the people just after liberation, and then actually they started with social welfare activities and helping the government in service distribution and all that. But what happened by the early 80s, donor assistance had turned private voluntary organizations into development agencies. Now they do not go for social welfare activities. They would say that we go to our development projects and with very specific goals in mind and very specific format. So what is happening is that for donation, actually, for donors are so much, very much involved in the NGOs, and the increased availability of large funding changes NGOs' role in the grassroots. Those who can take advantage of donor for NGOs are often urban-based, because all the embassies are in the city, and also international organizations, their offices are in the city. So the urban middle class are thus overrepresented within growing NGO sector, and often they lack mass-based rural constituencies. And to what extent these NGOs represent concerns of the marginalized groups? That is a big question. Or how can these NGOs build representative and participatory civil society? Another feature regarding NGOs is that they are increasingly adopting formal procedures and they are developing conservatism, secrecy, and protection, like say bureaucracy. Even there is a popular public opinion that NGO bureaucracy is stronger than state bureaucracy. And when I was conducting field work home and PhD in Mexico, I mean, in the village, my observation is that people feel shy. So go to the government offices. I mean, all these beautiful offices are there. I mean, banks and loan giving agencies or rural development offices and everything. But we do not have the dress, proper dress with them to go to these offices. How can we go to these offices barefooted or with my lungi on for main people? We have to have trousers to put on the board. I mean, there is that the boundary is created between the state bureaucracy and village people. Now when NGOs are actually becoming more professional, if I can say that, and they're becoming more efficient because of the donors, because they have to justify their donation. And now here I recommend that university teachers and also then the researcher class also coming up, who are engaged with these NGOs as consultants. This is a new business in Bangladesh and very profitable. So that is also one reason why the movement, social, I mean, intellectuals are also shifted from social movements. And also I can comment that in Bangladesh, the strengthening civil society through NGOs have actually weakened the state accompanied by declining state legitimacy. And some people have commented that actually they are becoming a virtual violent state. And how can NGOs be seen as agents of democracy when they undermine the institutional basis of political participation? But the major question is that while civil society has not grown very much in the front of contestation, it is important to note that resistance has always been part of the political culture in Bangladesh. And the next one. Okay. Okay. And affiliation is that Bengalis consider too much control under authoritarian rule as problematic. Following thoughts, risk averse, and romantic safety first model. The economic and political situation in Bangladesh can be explained. Although risks were too high, Bengalis rationally decided to participate in the liberation war to maximize expected profit. For understandable reasons, during the years after liberation, social unrest was widespread in the countryside. When they approached the danger level of real income, and Bengalis got frightened that they will fall below the disaster level. Their shock was tremendous because their expectation from independence was too high. It appeared that during those years of distress, people cared little whether the political system was democratic or not, as they desired stability established by the authority at any cost. Finally, when Thamin grasped the economic order, the regime lost its legitimacy on moral grounds. For the same logic, people welcomed the law and order established by the authoritarian military ruler Zia Ur Rahman and the prolonged military rule by the same Muhammad Esha. Now, in this picture, it's a writing of Margaret Thomas after the line, Fulbright was quite popular. There was a movement in the northern part of Bangladesh in Fulbright, which has been at the place of this year, and this is written where they promised in the name of Mother that they will definitely liberate Fulbright. Now, the first one is about cancer. This is in 2006. I mean, what happened is that in a small village of Tehuns, artisans and villagers in northern Bangladesh, they demanded an adequate and uninterrupted power supply for irrigation during the peak boro season, which is their staple food. But what happened is that they tried all means to make themselves heard, but when they were not heard, and they went out for demonstration, police fired on them. And two people were killed, and one pregnant woman child was killed in the womb. This created a reaction, and this mercenary approach to politics led to the uprising in Kansas, and about 12,000 local people with bamboo sticks gathered, and police again fired, and 23 people died, and more than 200 were injured. Now, this movement was not led by any party, political party, any civil society group, or any NGO. But local people, they organized themselves. They have no leader. When I ask, do you have any leader? Ropam is the name, but this was actually first from that university, and well, just no political affiliation. But Aumil is trying to co-opt. They propagated that, oh, Rabbani is our name. But he denied, no, he's not. So this is how, when there is a successful social movement, the political parties try to contend and get the credit. But the people of consort invoke the notion of a moral right that transcends class conflict or partisan politics. Now the second one is on Fulbari, that is the movement against transnational Fulbari. It's also in Northern Bengal, yes. Northern Bengal, this is Asian energy, which represents the interest of British, Australian and German interests, and they try to implement open trust method of coal mining. But it, well, also geological structure did not permit, and it would be adverse for people, land and water. Still they wanted to implement it. And then it was women and children who were the foremost to come out on the streets in protest. And three teenagers were killed, that created reaction, and 80,000 people gathered from surrounding villages demanding abandonment of the Fulbari project. And as an activist, I was there and observed occasions, interestingly, when women in the houses, even at night, they girded their husbands with daupati. Can you go? The woman is holding a kind of knife, which they use in the knife in the kitchen, so that Asian energy people are unable to bribe them. Because Asian energy was trying to bribe people, that we build houses like Australian standard for you, give us the land and go for open for mining. And religious persons allowed the mosques for gathering and their microphones for calling people in time. Children acted as messengers. So here, old and young people, religious people, men, women, and also Aborigines and Bengalis all got together. And eventually, government had to go to people's power and sign an agreement with the people steering the movement. So, well, I conclude that although Bengalis are intrinsically adaptive in nature, but the rulers actually puzzle Bengali personality with aggression. And being unable to be naturally counter-aggressive, most of the people are drowning in frustration, which is not their natural characteristic. In this condition of moral, economic, political disaster, there is every possibility for the Bengalis to rise up in protest to defend themselves against disaster, as they always do. Now the authoritarian regimes have not only caused social and political disorder, these have resulted in the growth of hostile mentality, causing individual disaster. Now my question is, how can people who survive on reciprocity match with hostility? Perhaps they don't. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have heard a very rich lecture, which is at the same time also very disturbing. Not disturbing in terms of the threat to multinational price something of only the shares. Disturbing in terms of the theoretical implication of the lecture. Professor Hussain is a fellow political scientist from Dhani Nagar. She will understand, probably also commentary. It used to be so much easier when I was an undergraduate. If your Orman's book had come out, if you wanted to learn about modality and you could measure it, all you had to measure was how many people read newspapers, how many people use flash toilets, how many people listen to the radio. Measure it. And you have it. The problem is, when you see this kind of data, you don't know how to account for it theoretically. I mean, you may be talking about an unfounded snow, you may be talking about Hindu nationalism, you may be talking about this data. You find a disturbing curvilinearity in terms of the use of symbols. The more educated tend to, at least
the Indian data, the more educated part of the electorate would sympathize with the new nationalism. In your case, we don't have the data, at least we have the data about madrasas. So that linearity is not there. So what are we going to make out of it in terms of the theory of modernity? My regret is such a challenging lecture, such an engaging lecture, unfortunately doesn't have enough time for a proper, meticulous, detailed conversation which should follow, because many of my colleagues have to leave soon for another lecture from morning until later, which starts at 7. So I propose the following. For those of my colleagues, I'm so pleased to see so many of my colleagues present today, and only shows how important Bangladesh is, not just because Hans, you put together Upar Bangla and Upar Bangla in terms of the two different forms of ideology, but also because we have lost something. This institute had a Bangladesh chair, so that some of these conversations, we also had a Pakistan chair, so we lost all those. My hope was that this lecture would have brought the embassy, and the embassy has had to break off in the last moment. So we couldn't put this to its proper political use. But nevertheless, so many of my colleagues have come, which shows how much interdisciplinary interest there is in some of the questions which are born in political science but have taken much bigger life of their own. So how will be if those colleagues who have to go out soon got the floor first to ask their questions, and after they have left, they have another round. So, Hans, we can go to the floor.
You want to go ahead?
Yes, I would, my basic remark, not question, would be that what you are saying, what I've heard from your presentation, is that the hijab is really a modern form of dress. It's not necessarily tradition, because it's also, it is a new form that wasn't necessarily being used in the Middle Ages, and it is being imported from outside. So this is, it would refer back to traditionalism, but I think one has to show that there's a kind of mixture in the perspective, especially the religious political perspective of the women, which contains both modernity and tradition. But it's in a way modernized. I think this distinction between modernism and tradition is what you are perhaps questioning. Mm-hmm. Would that be so? And that, but I was wondering how the women who wear hijabs regard the Bengali Muslims continue to wear sari. I mean, is there a chasm between the two? Is there criticism on the part of the hijab wearing women of the sari wearing Bengali Muslims? That would be
question.
In
question. Alright, then I'll give you the floor. If you want to stay on, we'll have a much longer conversation. You have to go too?
Yes.
Alright. Shall we then put together the question of the first round? So is the hijab modern or traditional? And do you want to take the floor now?
Yeah. I'd also have one question. Actually two questions. One is about Islamization and your use of that term. I've been thinking about that. Isn't it so that when we call a process of a reformist process, Islamization, aren't we prejudicing in any way? Aren't we saying that the forms of Islam that are being Islamized are not proper Islam, and shouldn't we therefore avoid that term? That was my first question. And the second one is about this, I don't know who they were, the Tablighi Jamaat, I think. Do the Tablighi Jamaat people really talk about Bengali Islam, Bengali Islam or something like that? Or are they using other categories?
Is it
from
Islam?
Our question? I wanted to say, what I thought was really common to the whole presentation that you made was about how power was being used. by different groups. So whereas the hijab is actually a symbol of power of the ulema, could have been the symbol of power of the ulema, is being subverted by the women who used it to express a different sort of power. And so isn't it the production and reproduction of power in various forums which women who are now preaching are seeking? It doesn't matter what they are preaching, it's more about what position that preaching gives them. So isn't modernity about now the sharing and taking of power rather than what the power is really about? Because that changes over time. That is contextualized, but what really remains common in that whole thing is about how power is being grabbed.
Mm-hmm. Since you said very politics question, and let me slightly reformulate this kind of question. Mm-hmm. Power is usually the ABC, power of A over B, to stop him from doing what he wants to do, or to get him to do what he would do otherwise, and C, that will give you legitimacy. So, when it comes to hijab, who are the ABC? Whose power over whom? Good. Why don't I close the first round here and we'll have your answers? Because it will take you at least 15 minutes to make it to your account.
Okay. Women wearing hijab, the relationship of young women wearing sari is not confrontational yet. The movement has, maybe because the movement has only started. And when I talk to them, according to them, they said that, they will change in time. Because this is not Islamic. Sari is not an Islamic dress. This is all right. But perhaps they will change gradually if we can motivate them. So we need to work on it. From a very much political partisan view, they will say that. But in the field, what happens is that, those who wear hijab, they wear it for different reasons. Individual motivations are various. So some of them very strategic, I can wear anything underneath and go out easily, wear something and then run. And I don't have to worry about cosmetics or very expensive dress. That was most of the women said that to me. That, these middle class women, they live such an expensive life, we can't. So wearing hijab is good for us, rather in the meantime, we get our education. But what will they do in future, therefore some of them also do not know. But many of them who are actively related with the movement and partisan people, those are activists, jihad activists, they will say that they have a mission. They have a mission to change the society or social order and replace it with Islamic order. And hijab, going into hijab is one symbol of that. I mean, so there will be not one answer, many answers to that. Yes.
Thank you. And that's going out with the lectures starting at 7. So let's begin from the end. Thank you very much.
Now, for some of the time, using the term Islamization, whether we should use it because that meaning that the only Islam is there and Jamaat Islam and other Islamist groups are now for the movement, they're trying to establish something, and whether that is Islamization, then what will happen to the body Islam? Conceptually, yes, you are right, conceptually that. But it's their term, Islamization, because they think that Muslims have to go back to the origin. That is the main mission. Going back to origin is going back to the architect. And that means Bengali Islam, whatever is there in practice, is definitely not pure Islam, if it is pure Islam. So, Islamization means bringing Bengali Muslim women, Bengali Muslims, to the fold of pure scriptural Islamic model. So is it Islamization?
And that is my question. Well, for me, you are right that if we say formalism, that means that we know the Islam is not real Islam, accepting that. And the second question is Tawhid. Now, the Tawhid, there is a difference between Jamaat-e Islam and Tawhid, because Jamaat-e Islam has a very specific political motive, but Tawhid does not. What Tawhid people do, they just preach Islam, and they said, oh, I'll come back, be more religious, sort of, more general. But the change, why I bring in this is that I observed a kind of change. What is that? Now, these Tawhid people used to move around the villages, but those are mainly men. And when only men went, settled somewhere, etc., but in the within the homesteads, they didn't go. So in the private sphere, if I can say just private sphere, so now they are taking their women with them, with permission, and were sending them inside. And women are not sitting. And what they're talking is very actually problematic is that now women actually perform the rituals and whatever we bring in the Bengali Islam code, they will go for it. Now these women, the bleeding women, would try to change that. With Jamaat cannot enter politically into that sphere, but Tawhid can. With their women and who go for 40 days on Shimla, and this sounds to be more say philanthropic kind of thing, but they have a mission too. So I found even this is very problematic for Bengali Islam.
And do they really say Bengali Islam? Do they use
Islam? No, they don't.
Now, hijab, or symbol of power, whose power over whom? Now, hijab is political, technically. It's not only a dress. That is why I bring in hijab in this argument. Of course, hijab is a dress, but wearing hijab, the way it is worn in Bangladesh now is political. So definitely power is there, a portion of power is there. Now the point is it women's power? Well, I would say that this is more, the power of the Islamist group, like who are advocating hijab, or leading this movement, hijab movement, because women are only identity markers. Like Mondovi, Jamaat-e-Islam is the part of whose deaths are used by Jamaat-e-Islam. And now these Jamaat people are also changing their a little bit. Interpretation is changing. But they will say that in India mainly it is changing, but in Bangladesh is not very much. But still they will say that harem or ghar or the house or home. I mean, this is very important. I mean, whatever happens, the war or battle outside happens to Islam. All right, you can fight and everything, but it has to be protected. It has to come back in the harem. And it has to be protected for centuries. And forever. It should be protected here. So harem is so valuable, and women sit in the harem. So when they will protect with this, the hijab is symbolic. That now, the main message is that in the global perspective, there is war going on, war on terrorism, and a lot of things that are going on. So they are bringing very consciously. So it is political. It's not false consciousness. Women who are wearing hijab, many of them are very conscious about it. But it does not increase women's power in the sense it increases power of the Islamists. But it also gives power to women who wear it because they can go to the outside, they can come to the different institutions, they can go for shopping, they can go for jobs. And these Islamic courses, as I was explaining, they have a big economic sector, employment there. And those women who work for them, they are employed in the banks or anything, whatever, what not. I mean, they have everything. So, yes, it is power. Women are willing, some women are willingly wearing hijab and saying that, okay, all right, we come for the movement because it is guaranteed that she will get a job, wherever. I mean, because they are taking, and the space is enlarged, like I said, they have a market, job market.
So in that sense, well, it does not take away patriarchy, as I said, because male domination over women remains. Because Islam doesn't say that patriarchy shouldn't be there. Patriarchy is very much there. But still women statistically would go for it at least now. What will happen in the future, I don't know. But at least now, when there is on the street, when ethnic is thrown on their faces, I mean, violence is there to mark. So they think that national culture has become so violent, and the Western one almost immoral, so what should we do? So hijab is a kind of shelter, perhaps they're spending, I mean, it is only temporary, I have said that.
I don't think we have solved this problem yet, because I'm sure there will be many more questions on these lines. Should we open second round now?
I'm sure, sure.
Now we are going to shoot the rear. Now that there are just a few of us, I'll start the second round with a question. So, is Bangladesh getting more modern or less?
Do you think there's a possibility of becoming a theocratic state?
Can I ask you this?
Do you
have a mentioned various types of dresses. So my question is, what is precisely an Islamic dress?
I'm questioning in which way other countries influence this process of Islamization. For example, I think Saudi Arabia, they give money to the madrasas, in which way this is important for this process.
I'll
start from the bottom. How other countries influence, the present situation which I was trying to discuss, these are the developments of, say, of the 90s, in general, we can say about 15 years or so, that radically, very rapidly, some of the things are changing. Now, other countries' involvement is there, donors are there from the Middle Eastern countries. And it started after 1975, when the military ruler Jordan took over and legitimized his schools by building a relationship with the Middle Eastern countries and making an Islamic kind of identity. And from then on, Islamic countries are giving large amounts of the donations for activities. And GI, Jamaat Islam, has a good connection with these Middle Eastern countries. And it's hard to collect information, but whatever I could know is that what they do is that when they try to explain the thing, they relate it with Soviet Union, former Soviet Union. This is, see, Soviet Union also gave money for the progressive parties. But they couldn't do anything. So now what we are doing, we don't waste money. So whatever money comes from outside of the Middle Eastern countries, what they said that they invest the money. Now they make it sustainable. Let's say they have hospitals, as I said, they have so many things. And these are profitable. In that way, it is modern. I mean, it's a free market. And so they are also a partner, a stakeholder. And about politics. Now, when the Middle Eastern countries give money, they give it for a mission. I mean, it's and accountability is less. These days, NGOs which get money from, say, suppose European Union or something, their accountability is more. How do they spend the money? Sort of big question.
But the Islamic NGOs which get money, I mean, they say that, well, we are building for Islam. I mean, well, in broad, say, mind, it's all there, everything is for Islam. So that is a very good chance for them to get money, and money comes from outside. So when money comes from outside, and these are spent for political purposes, and I said that those countries are definitely involved. Especially I knew that most Iran is related to, and because the success of the revolution in Iran in establishing an Islamic state rather than other Islamic countries, I mean that attracts many of the Muslims in Bangladesh and also the activists. And so whenever they would go for a conversation, they would definitely refer to Iran. That well, we learn from Iran, even about women. There are some Iranian movies are these days very popular. They make very good movies, and they also come to Bangladesh. And if you see, Iran is Islamic, but see that they are making so good movies. So Iran has become a very good example for the Islamic activists. I would say that yes, you are right. I think that outside influence is there. Now, what is an Islamic dress? The Islamists who are now trying to give us a gender discourse, if I can say, that what is ideal for women, what is fair, what is proper, sort of, for women, they would also mention dress. But not they are not tailors. I mean, they won't tailor the dress. But they would give the ideology that you have to cover the whole body. And when hijab, previously also Bengali women, I mean Muslim women, modesty was the word used. Khatro, shali hota, modesty in general. Okay, fine. Yeah, that is for the, okay, good enough, shali. Body language and behavior pattern, boys, everything together. It's a big thing, but still, bhatrota. You have to know how to be in this world. Okay, quota, that is quota. But now, no, that's not. Quota means something, a dress. That is very new now. Quota never meant a particular dress. But now, quota is a dress. What kind of dress? They won't tailor it for you. But they will say that, look at this, that means hijab, which we saw. But this is good. The hijab, they would prefer hijab. That is the contestation, you know, that, well, because the woman would be in a situation, they would just bring in the sari, end of the sari, and just cover the head and say, okay, I'm doing for that, no problem. But a Bengali woman cannot do this now. They will need a definite dress. This is very problematic. Okay, now, theocratic spirit. Now, if I can say, if I understand them all right, that Jamaat Islam and also a few other Islamist parties together, I mean, they are in a movement, definitely. Now, they have a target. That target is capturing state power. Very clear. They don't say that they are doing social work. No. They are doing social work, but definitely they want to capture power. That is very clear. Now, my observation is that they are training on two grounds. On one ground, they are contesting the elections, sharing power with the established political parties in alliance with them, and accepting democracy, Western or whatever, and trying to be in the legislature, in the parliament, and capturing one or two portfolios and doing something. This is one. But on another ground, what they are doing, they are organizing into tailors. And they just attack. They go for really attacking the system, attacking the establishment. Now, see the contradiction. They are sharing the establishment, but they are also attacking the establishment. They will attack progressive people, writers, intellectuals, university teachers, or in their favor is progressive according to them. Or they will definitely attack court system, because they primarily believe that this court system is not good, because law has to be according to Quran.
So there are forces there, okay? And also Bengali spaces, Bengali spaces, theaters or cultural functions and so on. So now, in this town, they are attacking the establishment and criticizing it. So making a counter discourse. And they're saying that, or at least they're telling the people that, look, when this system is no good, when we go to power, we'll change it according to Islam. But the very strategy that they are also sharing power and also acting against the establishment both at the same time. Now, becoming a theocratic state is really, really very difficult in case of Bangladesh. Because, as I was saying, that Bengali people, I mean, their strength, their agency, we cannot undermine their agency because they fight, they're fighters. Always, in every generation, there is a crisis, the whole nation fights, right? And when they rise up, they just don't care for anything. So, when it is very, and there is no tolerance of authoritarianism. So, if you look at the past, I don't say that there is any space for is Bangladesh becoming a theocratic state. Theoretically, it is not possible. And physically, I don't see any evidence because the history of Bengal is a history of social movements. People or businessmen, I mean, they don't tolerate gain conflict on Islam. Now, Prophet Minister's question, okay, it's a very difficult question. But is Bangladesh modern or not? Well, I'll say that Bangladesh, Bangladeshi, when I say Bengali culture, what did I mean? I meant Bengali rural urban culture. Yeah, and it's a vastly different kind of culture yet, because Bangladesh is not industrialized. So even now, villages actually dominate. Even people living in the cities, their lifestyle is close to business kind of lifestyle. Because it's only say second generation or something or third generation that they are educated in Western education and becoming modern social things. So they are Bengali, and if you say it's traditional, you can say it's traditional, but if, according to me, it's Bengali peasant kind of rural urban kind of culture that they hold. Now, modernizing agencies are there, modernizing functions is there in the market and education and different sectors, and people are accepting those agencies and their movements. And it's only the Islamic social movements that has raised a big question that why, what is happening? I mean, but what they mean also is a compromise with modernity. Because they are also saying that we are modern. So if they say that they are modern, how can we say no? Because they are also accepting, anything, whatever is available in the market and signify modernism. Even for women, they have found a solution for women. Like where you wire hair and you go for education, you go for work, for shopping, whatever, in the public space. Otherwise, you can't. Yes, it is a problem. Why should women go without their bed? But I would say it is a compromise. And it's modernism, according to them. So even if it's a very difficult question, I don't say that Bangladesh is traditional. Bangladesh is a modern country, modern state.
Actually, I meant quite same way. The post-war indicators of modernity were quite empirically, quite clearly specified. Transformation of a society in terms of urbanization, secularization, going from animate to inanimate energy. These are more or less criteria. My question is, are these criteria adequate? All are cases of anomalous cases, like literary examples. You can take Monica Ali's bricklaying. You see one place of resurgent religion there, or in Pamuk's story, it's college girls protesting by killing themselves. Now, protesting against the requirement to be modern as I will want them to be modern. Mm-hmm. This is what I call anomalies. Facts looking for new theory. So has the time come to ask new questions like what is the role of values in a theory of modernity? Because the old theories of modernity, which is why they could not distinguish between modernization and westernization. So do values play a role? Is context important? And think of the role of context. If you're talking in terms of A and B, the young woman, the young student who told you, I don't mind wearing a hijab, I can see you, you can't see me. Wearing a hijab gives you more power over you. You can't control me because you can't see me, but I can see you. So in that context, this hijab is bringing her an additional unit of power. However, if the hijab became a method of some man deciding how you as a woman will conduct yourself in public, then it is a distinct loss of power. So as a student of power, we have to contextualize the phenomenon and look at it better. So the role of context. Context never played a role in the old theory of modernization. Third, role of culture, which is where norms and law. I mean, Bengal is a fish, and in 1971, fish eating became a method of distinguishing lower forms of Islam from the higher forms. The Punjabis had contempt for that kind of foreign Islamic method. Fourth, identity. Now, identity never played a role in the theories of modernity, of modernization. Think of Lalilala and that generation. Whereas today, in the postmodern theory of modernization, the actor is going to decide if she is modern or not, which is quite appealing, but in terms of theory, very disturbing. I call it the Alice in Wonderland way of looking at reality. Now that the anthropologists have mostly gone, I could tell you that for political scientists, an actor-oriented approach is important, but it can only be the beginning of an argument. Otherwise, we fall back into the problem of the snake or the rope. I see something, I can't reach it. I have to measure it in terms of my perception of it. Now, if my perception is wrong, then I'm going to think that either a snake or a rope. So, is perception old? That's where, as a member of the Excellence Cluster, I'm asking this question. Where do we get our categories? The question about intervention from outside. It can't be all external. There is enough enthusiastic acceptance of the village for us to believe that they can't. All these women could not have been born. Some of them genuinely want to go back to something else. But having said that, all those madrasas are not just indigenous. There is a lot of money, not only in Bangladesh, but also in Kerala. The linear growth in madrasas is not entirely indigenous. There is money involved. It's a career. It's a second track career option. Opening madrasas and running them. So, that's the fifth argument against the old theory of modernity. The exogenous element in modernity. So, I'll wind up by saying, if we're looking for a new theory, why don't we say modernity is about increasing choice? So if we look at this complex range of behavior and ask ourselves, is this thing contributing to choice or denying choice? So we can probably add up the entire range of activities taking place in Bangladesh now compared to before, and ask ourselves, has the new Bangladesh got more choice for its rich and poor, Muslim and non-Muslim, women and men, than before? So that, I'm not giving an answer, I'm simply saying that maybe the method of asking this question should question the old methods of measurement and bringing a new method, increasing choice. Having said that, it is a very liberal biased method. Choice is a very liberal construction. Now, how often would you hear someone say that what you want is not what you need? What you're choosing is no good for you. I know it better. Plato said it. Doctors say it, parents say it, professors say it. So we are going back, again to the anomaly. Can we, in terms of modern liberal political science, pronounce on societies which are not themselves developed? Or do you have to be liberalized first so that we can theorize about you? Then, if that is the problem, then we have made no progress at all. But I think we have reached a stage where we should think and have private conversations in party terms, unless there is another question or comment.
Can I come to this choice?
By all means.
Now, choices, that is a problem, because choices are sometimes very cultivated. Like say, even for example, my body, as I own at least my body, but actually I don't. Because I can't donate any of my organs so easily. Because then, after I die, what will happen to my body? It's not only me, my family, my parents, my society. Because there is a very wide ritualistic sphere. Because what others will do in my body is their part. So what will happen to those rituals if I just don't say that, oh no, Lord, I own my body and I don't care so much? No, what will happen to culture? Because everybody knows what will they do with my body when I die. How can I deny that? So even about my own body, I can't make my choice. So sometimes it is so difficult to make choices because it's cultural.
Choices are cultural, and that I have to think about it, because the body has emerged as a battleground. What can be done with the body to decide who has won? How many men are interested in women's bodies? Because, as you said yourself, I want to quote somewhere, what happens to women is a symbol, it sends a message. So men can dress the way they want, women are not allowed to, because men's dignity depends on what women are allowed to do. Is that a cultural, contextual position, or can we talk about a cross-cultural thing? Look at the United States. Has a woman got enough right over her body to have an abortion? That's a crucial question. The anomaly there is, this is from the Bible and the fundamentalists, the woman doesn't own her body, God does. And their further argument is, how can she kill a life which has already taken shape? So it's not the woman's body, but the body of the fetus, which becomes perversely the argument of the fundamentalist against the mother. That's how the American debate about choice is going at the moment. We can take the issue of choice even further. Who is allowed to choose is a political question. And every constitution has a problem with it. Are women allowed to choose to get an alimony or not? Or are women allowed to choose whether women get an alimony or not? India, which prides itself on a liberal democratic constitution, is not able to come to a decision, as we know from the Shabbat case. So, it's very easy to talk about choice and the ultimate criteria, but is it cross-cultural? Second, can it be operationalized? Because what is the image of the analysis? Who chooses? The mother or the fetus? And can the fetus please tell us what you want? Or must the fetus be represented by the church?
Well, in this case, it's about the fetus, okay. But also it's very homeless. It's illegal under the agreement. So many people will say that, well, it can't. But if look at that side, I mean, the soldiers who just kill themselves, I mean, kill them, they're watching at bombs, and, but it is highly criticized. Why can't a person decide about his or her own body? I mean, it's not fetus, it's just his or her own body. I want to kill myself. So what's the problem of the society? Kind of.
And
so, choice is so limited,
I guess. But that's again the mirror of Einstein's political science. And the whole idea of political science is Mr. Hobbes. We have political science because Hobbes told us that life has to be protected at any cost. So, you give up the right to kill, and in return, your life will be protected. But when someone comes and says, no, my life is part of my argument, then Hobbesian political science can't quite decide if the man is mad or he's trying to tell us something which we can't understand in terms of our categories. So you're talking about a post-Hobbesian political problem for which our science has not equipped us. And this is why cultural anthropology is so important, because cultural anthropology helps us. And you're smiling because we have to stand up our hands. With the anthropologists now, please come up and tell us what we do with this kind of data, because we can't understand it. The index and social number defeat political scientists' ways of deciding if you're wrong or not wrong.
Thank you.
I would say that are you really a political science head or the economist head now? If you're a two-headed person. Look, if there are no other questions, maybe we should formally close the session, but the conversation will go on. Now, I like lectures when we go away with unsolved questions. Because that is the strength and weakness of this institute. It's a strength in the sense that I can now go and harass our anthropologists and other colleagues who deal with memory as a variable. Again, that's real political science. That is the interdisciplinarity, and that is what is making the excellence cluster so exciting. But it can also be a weakness. It can also be weakness in the sense that we are cut off from the mainstream debates in our sciences. Political scientists in the mainstream are also struggling with these issues. But it's a very small development with just a few of us. And those of us who deal with the identity have left the room already and did not engage us in this debate at that level. So, I sometimes have this uncomfortable feeling that we are not doing justice to our data or to our theory. Not that we are too comfortable or we don't have any more lectures and disturbing lectures like yourself. So those of you who have survived this long summer day, please join me in thanking Professor Hussain for your awesome start. I hope this paper will have a second life in the high enough success. Give us a second opportunity. I like lecture with the
sister. You need to be there.